I'd like to welcome Michael Aylward, winemaker at Ocean 8, to the show. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Jill. How are you?
And hello, I'm very well, thank you. How cold is it down there right now?
It's actually raining at the moment, and I'd say it's 8 or 9 degrees, so it's absolutely freezing. So we've got the fire going, and it's a bit early to have a glass of wine, but a cup of tea maybe.
but give it another hour and a half and it's completely fine timing. So Michael, I was down there last weekend, as you know, because I didn't get to meet you, which I would love to next time. I've been a big fan of your wines for a long time. I discovered them 5 years ago when I was in Mornington, and I think it was a bit of a random, and fell in love with your Pinot Gris. Your sparklings were amazing. So I walked away with them. I think I had 6 sparklings sent and a few bottles of a few other bits and pieces. But I was really blown away with the beauty and the finesse and elegance of your wine. So thank you for joining us so you can tell us all about it. Why don't you give us your story of how you got into wine and the backstory of Ocean 8?
All right. So to start, when I finished school, I didn't really have an idea of what I wanted to do. So I went to uni and I did a science degree. So I was studying science from the age of sort of 19 through to 23. While I was doing that, my parents started to establish a winery down on the peninsula. And mum and dad, they always loved the peninsula and they loved the peninsula wine. So I remember as a kid they'd be drinking the Piringas and the Stonies and the Muriducks. So these guys that sort of established the region. These wineries were pretty amazing. They did a lot of the prospecting for us down here. So they discovered what varieties worked, what didn't work. And it came about that the peninsula was really well suited to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And Dad, loving the wines coming out of the region, they decided to buy a property. They bought a 100-acre cattle farm, and this was back in 97, 98. They started to plant that out to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So they did a lot of soil testing, a lot of research, and discovered that it was a really good site. And so at that time, I was studying, but I used to go down and work in the vineyard just to really earn some money. And the team that we had there, we had a great team that were really passionate, and they loved what they were doing and the business that they were developing. And that really started to rub off on me. So I started to enjoy going down there and working on the property more than going to uni in some ways. Finished the uni degree and then moved. I moved down to the peninsula when I was 22 to get really involved in the wine side. So I did a couple of years in the vineyard there, and then moved into the winery and the winemaking, and worked under the team there. And we were just starting to get involved in the sales side of things. So we're going out to market, and my father sold the business. So he had a very nice offer come through, and accepted the offer. And at that time, I decided that's what I wanted to do. I was getting quite excited by the wine thing. So I was pretty disappointed when he sold it. But he came and said to me, "Well, we want to stay in the wine business. We love the peninsula." So then I sort of had my opportunity to come through, and I started back in the day. We just had a three. So once the sale went through, we still had a 3-acre plot of Pinot Gris, and that's where I really made my first wine off. So and I know that you're sort of interested in talking about the Pinot Gris, but the Gris was. It was at that time, so the Queeleys were doing some great stuff. Brie was just on the radar. It still wasn't a mainstream wine, but to give you an idea of how popular Pinot Gris became, so I started with 200 dozen bottles of Gris, thinking, how am I going to go and sell all this? And went out to some of the great the restaurants. So Donovan's was one. Pearl, I don't know if you remember Pearl. Pearl was a three hat restaurant back in the day, but these guys put the Gris straight on the list, and we got through that 200 cases. And then what we saw at that time was there was a real movement in the restaurants. So the chefs were, Australia was becoming more partnered with Asia, a lot more Asian ingredients coming through, and the chefs were really jumping on those ingredients like your ginger, your lemongrass, your corianders. And not many wines go with those flavours. What we found is particularly Mornington Pinot Gris, which gets this beautiful texture, but also this beautiful freshness that comes through, it matches really well with a lot of those flavours. So we started to get listings by the glass in so many of these restaurants where the chefs were experimenting with a lot of these ingredients. Over a period of 4 years, we went from 200 cases to 3,000 cases. So it grew very, very quickly, and we maxed out on our vineyard at about 3,000 cases, so we're at full production. So that was quite amazing to sort of to see that journey happen. But Mornington Gris does get this extra bit of texture, and the cool climate brings through this beautiful acidity as well. So they're quite the Pinot Gris from Mornington are quite unique, but they are absolutely delicious wines.
They are absolutely delicious, like all of them. And there aren't an amazing amount, I shouldn't say amazing, there aren't a huge number of varietals that are really produced, but the ones you do produce are produced to quite an exquisite standing is what I'm really seeing. And the more people I speak to, whether it's winemakers from other regions or you know, consumers who kind of know a bit of their stuff and like to traverse Australia, it always comes back to the wines in Mornington Peninsula are of a very quite an incredible level. So I'm sure you do get that all the time. What do you think it is? I mean, you've touched on it a bit, but what is it about Mornington? I mean, apart from the obvious terroir, which you've spoken to, and you know, you own the flagship varietals, but there's got to be a bit more to it than that. What do you think it is?
Yeah, well, I definitely see two main features of Mornington, and if you come down and visit the region, you see it's very undulating.
Yes,
there's some old volcanic soils around Red Hill, so up on the higher points, and that soil is distributed through different parts of the peninsula. So depending on where you plant, you might be on that sort of soil. So the soil compositions are quite amazing, and then you get closer to the beaches where you get sandier soils. So there's a very diverse sort of spectrum of soil profiles. But the other thing is the maritime climate, which Imogen touched on before. But the way the maritime climate works is it's like an air conditioner for the region. So the water surrounding the region is very cool, and even through summer it's very cool. But the winds come off there and act as an air conditioner and cool the region down. And I think that really comes through in the wines. That's sort of one of our key features. So that's giving the wines this elegance and beautiful acidity, which all the producers... most of the producers down here at the moment are really tapping into that and going for elegance. So we're not trying to make big, powerful, rich wines, but we're getting these beautiful, elegant perfume wines. And I'm finding the Pinot Gris and particularly the Chardonnays, they're very consistent and quite simple to make. I know we hang our hat on Pinot Noir, which from year to year changes. It's very, very difficult to get consistency, but the Chardonnays and the Pinot Gris are getting great consistency down there.
Yes, I think not sure whose words these were that I'm going to mention, but leaner, racier wines. That seems to be very much what you specifically are about, let alone the Mornington Peninsula. And I really love your Verve range, your Chardonnay. I walked away with a few of those. That's a beautiful, beautiful wine. I think that was the 2020 that would be drinking at the moment. Tell us a bit about the Chardonnays.
All right. I love Chardonnay. I think it's my favourite variety. But when we started the business back in 2004, there was a lot of big sort of richer, oakier Chardonnays on the market, and the market was flooded. So it was very tricky to get listings in the restaurants, particularly with a new brand and going out with a Chardonnay. But when we started the business and I was pretty green and had to develop my palate, I was lucky enough to do some travel over to particularly Burgundy and Alsace to look at the varieties that we're growing. But what was amazing was the vintages that we went and saw over there. So we're over there for 2003, which was quite a warm year for Burgundy. And we found tasting the Chardonnays there, they were richer, fuller bodied. And they lacked the acidity. But what we found towards the end of the day is you were it was so much rich Chardonnay, and you were a little bit over it. And then we went back in 2004, which is arguably one of the best years for Burgundy, for white Burgundy. It wasn't so good for the Pinots, but it was great for white Burgundy. But every Chardonnay that we're tasting from that vintage had this amazing acidity and almost grapefruit sort of flavours. And then we also went to Chablis as well, which I just loved Chablis. I thought, but, you know, that got us thinking, well, you know, we're in this cool climate. We get good acidity. The market's flooded with these big, rich, oaky, buttery Chardonnays. So let's try and do something very, very different. So we went down that sort of Chablis style. So we looked at how Chablis make their Chardonnays. They, you know, it's old barrels. They get a lot of texture from barrel stirring and the lees stirring. They pick the fruit. The fruit's picked on the earlier side because they struggle to get the ripeness, which means there is high acidity. So we came back and we picked our Chardonnay fruit probably a week before anyone else on the peninsula, and we pressed it all into old barrels and then used the lees to sort of get some nice subtle richness into that. And the first Verve we made was 2008. So Verve just means fresh and lively, but we're trying to describe what we were doing with that wine. And the first one was probably too lean. Then we started to bring some more Malo ferment in to get more of that, the creaminess and the richness in there. Now we've got this great style of Chardonnay, and we did really well in the media because we were doing something quite different with Chardonnay. So very proud of that wine, but. So if you like Chablis and you like lean styles of Chardonnay, then definitely have a look at that Verve. It's beautiful.
Yes, yeah, I completely agree. I'd love to speak about your sparklings a bit because they weren't on for tasting, and I completely understand why they wouldn't be. They are very beautiful, and I understand that it sort of came out of your time that you spent in France, specifically in Champagne, I would assume, and that might have been a bit of an influence from Remy Krug.
Yes. it was an amazing experience, but we did go and visit there, and they sort of opened up their house to us and took us out for lunch, and Remy Krug sat down and just told us, he was more in the marketing side, but went through the whole story, and I just loved it. I love the making of the sparkling and the disgorging and the whole process. And he said probably the most important thing is the aging, so getting that age in there, so you're developing some of those yeast, the autolysis and the brioche characters. And so off the back of that lunch, I just wanted to have a try. So we've got two sites for Chardonnay. One's up in Red Hill, which is very cool. And so I thought that site was probably well suited. So pick the fruit nice and early. And then we made, it was only 40 dozen, so tiny amount. And we aged it. We decided we're going to age it for 10 years to try and develop some of those characters. Yeah, it was 2005 was the first one we made, it was a nice wine, but the 2006 was just absolutely amazing, and I wish I had more of it. I wish I had some left, but we haven't made it every year, but in the cooler years, because what happens in the warmer years, the fruit ripens so quick, and we sometimes miss that window to pick for the sparkling, but in the cooler years, we are getting some nice batches off there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, anyone who has the opportunity to drink the sparklings, they've got to give it a go. Actually, any of your wines. I think on tasting at the moment, you have your Pinot Gris, you've got the Verve Chard, you have the Rosé, which was beautiful as well. And of course, you have the two Pinots. You had the Aylward Pinot, which I think that's a fairly recent thing, isn't it? The Aylward wines?
We've actually always made the Aylward. So, The detail that you need to put into growing good quality Pinot is there is so much work involved and a lot of passes through your vineyard, knowing your site really well. But one of the keys is hand picking. It's all got to be hand picked, so you're selecting the fruit, but also your cropping levels. You can't crop Pinot high; it dilutes the fruit too much, and you come out with quite an insipid Pinot. So what most of the producers that make Pinot will do is they'll go through and do a green harvest and reduce the crops, so lower the crops. So if you imagine a vine will give you, 30 bunches on a vine, what we do is the green harvest will bring it back to 20 bunches, so the vine's putting more effort into less fruit. which is hopefully thickening those skins a little bit more too, because the skins are very thin. And then what we do for the alewood is we think it's our best flock, it's our best acre, but we reduce that down to 10 to 12 bunches, so it's a lower crop. So we really want to show the difference between the Pinots is that detail, so going down, cropping lower to try and get the better quality fruit.
Yeah, okay, well, I have to say it was drinking absolutely magnificently. For the price point, though, the other Pinot Noir, especially in Mornington, this is a bit of a thing, and it would probably be the only slight downside, and I guess it's a bit of pigeonholing as well, is that the price point of a lot of the wines, especially the Pinots from Mornington, are quite high in comparison to what a lot of our regions. That could be fully based on the fact that they are, exceptional wines. Why do you think that is?
A couple of things, but Pinot is very hard to grow. There's very few places in the world where you can grow it. So we're very lucky around Melbourne to have a dress circle that's suitable for Pinot.
Sure.
It's very expensive to grow. So you see these Burgundies coming out now, like even the lowest tiers of Burgundies are over $100. A lot of the New Zealand Pinots now are getting up over $100. But there is a huge market for Pinot as well, which... And the people that drink and enjoy Pinot, they do look for elegance and really nice subtle characters in the Pinot. So to get those, you have to work. You've got to work your vineyard pretty hard to get that quality into the fruit. And I think there is quite a good respect for people that grow Pinot and people that enjoy Pinot. They see the detail that goes into it, and I'm sure that's why the prices are up there on Pinot. It's very hard to grow and make a Pinot sub $40 and make a living.
Yeah, no, it completely makes sense, but I actually think it's important for people to hear it from someone like you. So, I think it's completely justified, but it's nice to hear it that way. So, Michael, for people who don't know Oceanate, let's do a little bit of a spruik. So, with the Cellar Door, I know you're tasting those five wines I mentioned before. How do people find you? What are you near? Are you close to a restaurant where they can go for lunch after? Give a little bit of a spruik of the area.
We're actually just around the corner from 10 minutes by track from the restaurant there. So we're quite hidden away and tucked away. We've got a beautiful garden setting, so you sort of can come and sit and enjoy a glass or come and have a tasting. But we're right in the heart of sort of Red Hill. There's a lot of Hatter restaurants within, a 5K radius of our little cellar door there. So I'd really, if you were heading down to the Mornington Peninsula, I would definitely book a nice lunch or a dinner somewhere, and we're probably that little place that you'd go to in between to hopefully get a really nice wine tasting and learn a bit about the region too. I think we talk very well about the region and also the other producers involved there. So the region's great. We'll recommend others to go and see as well. So definitely come down and immerse yourself in the region. It's absolutely beautiful.
Look, I can second that 100%. And even though it's cold, it is definitely worth it. So, Michael, thank you very much for joining us this morning and giving your take. Your wines are exquisite. So anyone who hasn't tried them must give a go and do visit. And it is a very beautiful, very pristine cellar door and area. So thank you very much for your time. And
Thanks,
I look
Julie.
Forward to meeting you in person next time I'm down in the Mornington.
Thanks very much.